You had given me some information about Webb, but I don't think you said anything about Reuben and who Reuben was.
Reuben was my supervisor. He was actually got into it very indirectly. I was hired to work for Kellogg by a vice president named Howard Dimmick, D-I-M-M-I-G, who at that time was the Kellogg representative on the Polymerization Process Corporation's committee of company representatives, or representatives of the companies that were funding this research, which were Standard Oil Company of New Jersey and Standard Oil Company of Indiana, the Phillips Petroleum Company, and the M.W. Kellogg Company. But he was transferred to the New York office, and the directorship of the laboratory was changed to Louis C. Reuben, who was my laboratory supervisor. But I don't mean to sound, I don't want to sound mean here, but his involvement was strictly a matter of company policy, because he had nothing whatever to do with any of the work. He didn't conceive of it in the first place. He wasn't the person that oversaw the research, but he was simply my boss at Kellogg, and it was required that when I published a paper under the Kellogg flag, my supervisor's name would go on it also. So Louis C. Reuben became a co-author of our first paper and of our subsequent papers.
Okay.
But two of the other co-authors, Benedict Webb Reuben, and there was one other one on the later paper. George Webb was a young chemical engineering graduate from Solomon.
Solomon, yeah.
George Webb was a chemical engineering graduate at MIT who joins the Kellogg staff shortly after I did. And Kellogg was awfully good about providing me with all the kinds of help I could possibly use. It was a marvelous company to work for. And they recognized that once I had this idea of correlating thermodynamic properties with the later became known the Benedict Webb Reuben equation of state, that I would need help, because there were a lot of other mixtures, and pure hydrocarbons for that matter, to be tackled in the same way. Mm-hmm. So they assigned George Webb, a recent chemical engineering graduate from MIT, to work with me. And they couldn't have chosen a better man, because George was one of these taciturn, unflappable, the Scotch, and from New England, and he undertook the most tedious, apparently unrewarding kinds of research. I did my share of it too, but he was my partner in it, full partner, in looking up data and in interpolating to even values of the density or pressure or whatever else we needed the data for, and then by old-fashioned hand-crank calculators, using the method of least squares, finding the most suitable parameters in the Benedict Webb Reuben equation of state to fit all these data points. It was terribly tedious and unrewarding work. We spent a couple of years at it, but in the end, first we finished the first four normal hydrocarbons, methane, ethane, propane, and butane. We published on that. And then we extended it to 12 hydrocarbons altogether, including a couple of olefins, isobutene, propylene. I guess that was the only two we fit into at that time. Isobutane, normal pentane, isopentane, normal hexane, normal heptane, and tried to fit it to the aromatic hydrocarbons, benzene and toluene and so forth, but we struck out there because it doesn't work for them very well. So we had to limit it to the paraffinic hydrocarbons in the olefins. But most of the mixtures that Kellogg was dealing with in the distillation separation of light hydrocarbon mixtures that get up to 6 or 7 atom compounds, so that we didn't run into any cyclic compounds to speak of. So it was very successful in dealing with those. And after that proved so satisfactory, and it was evident to Kellogg that applied physical chemistry was helpful in solving many of their problems, well, I was given a whole series of other problems, which on the whole we solved quite successfully. Most interesting to me were the ones dealing with azeotropic and extractive distillation. There I had to arrange to correlate the properties of mixtures of hydrocarbons with non-paraffinic volatility enhancing agents like toluene. No, not toluene. What did we use? For extractive distillation, we used phenol. And for azeotropic distillation, what the hell did we use? I have to look at my list of publications.
Hey, here's the
methanol.
Methanol?
Yeah. So we had to set up to measure liquid vapor equilibrium in first ternary mixtures such as methane. Well, let's look at it. Methanol, toluene, and normal heptane, for example. And we found there that the Benedict-Weber-Rubin equation of state wasn't adequate to deal with it. The non-ideality of the mixtures required that you not calculate the parameters in the equation just from those of the pure hydrocarbons. There were some in the equation there were some multi-suffix parameters that were relevant to the mixture but not relative to the pure compounds. It had to be determined by additional experimental measurements on the mixtures themselves. But once those measurements were available, these additional parameters could be evaluated, and the equation was still fairly useful for correlating these data too. And I guess the Kellogg company has gone on and used it in its future work. Oh, I've lost track of it, of course.
Now, part of this was, this problem was, if I'm correct, was brought about because of the need for more toluene for TNT is a wore out
effort
was developing.
That is exactly correct, yeah.
Okay. And did you not also work on a continuous flow calorimeter?
Yes. Once I showed, I mean, the Kellogg company, I guess, realized that I had capabilities that I didn't know I had myself, because I'd never done any continuous flow calorimeter before at all. And they needed, it was quite important in their cracking and reforming process to know what the heat duty of the reactors were. They needed information on the heats of cracking and heats of formation of, heats of cracking and heats of reforming of a number of the hydrocarbons that they were processing. And that was before the Bureau of Standards had completed all the fine work that Brickwitty and some of his associates had done to provide much of these data. And they had to be determined experimentally. So even though I'd had no prior experience in calorimetry, I was assigned the task of getting these data too. And Fred Keyes, I think, from MIT, was a consultant to Kellogg, and he was familiar with work which one of his and my MIT professor, chemistry professors, Sam Collins, had done on low-temperature calorimetry, and recommended that a Collins-type vacuum-insulated calorimeter be built for experimental work that we would do on measuring the heats of reaction, cracking or reforming, or hydrocarbons at temperatures up to 400 or 500 degrees centigrade. Well, I was convinced right from the beginning that at temperatures this high, the Keyes and Collins type calorimeter, which depended on vacuum insulation, wasn't going to work because of radiative heat transfer at these high temperatures. So I persuaded the company. Oh, they had hired one of Keyes's research assistants, a fellow named it's in here somewhere, but never mind. A very able laboratory technician, but not a highly educated physical chemist, to build a Keyes-type vacuum-insulated calorimeter to try to make these measurements. And the heat losses from the calorimeter at the high temperatures at which they operated just swamped the heat effects that they were looking for. It was obvious that it wasn't going to work. So I persuaded the company to let me build a flow calorimeter that had ordinary, I forget what kind of insulation we used, but some of the best thermal insulation one could get on a somewhat larger scale so that the heat losses wouldn't be that serious a fraction of the heat of reaction that we were looking for. And we built it and operated it quite successfully on various first thermal cracking and reforming processes. And later we extended it to build a calorimeter that contains small amounts of cracking or reforming catalyst in it, and for catalytic processes too. That work was done late in my career at Kellogg, just before they took on the wartime gaseous diffusion project, and I never had time even to negotiate with the company for permission to publish that, so that never got published.
You also did some before Kellex was formed. I'm not sure, but I think this is correct. Then you also did some work on diffusion process with hydrogen, separating hydrogen.
That's right. That
gas
was
mixture.
It was one of those most that's what's known as serendipity, accidental, happy results from unexpected chances. Yes. After the Kellogg Company had found that I was pretty good at unraveling the basis for various novel separation processes, the work I'd done on azeotropic and extractive distillation sort of solidified me with the company. They decided that they had a need for a process for extracting hydrogen from the products of cracking, because hydrogen was subsequently needed for hydroforming or some other process. And it was recommended to them that they use a I don't know how they got onto the track there. Dear, dear, I'll have to consult my autobiography if it goes up that far. Recovery of hydrogen from refinery gases by mass diffusion. Yes, here it is. I'll read you some of this because it's all pertinent. In the summer of 1941, I was assigned to a new research problem which indirectly led to my being given 6 months later the most significant engineering development problem of my entire life. The M.W. Kellogg Company was developing processes for cracking or reforming hydrocarbons, which needed an inexpensive source of impure hydrogen. As hydrogen was a minor constituent of many refinery gas streams, process was desired that would extract hydrogen from them. In 1939, C.J. Mayer of the U.S. Bureau of Mines had published an account of his research on a process he proposed for concentrating hydrogen in gas streams by taking advantage of its high diffusion coefficient into steam, from which it could then be separated by partial condensation. Mayer called the process atmolysis. Ubman and Keith asked me to set up equipment and run it to determine how the purity and yield of hydrogen and consumption of steam depended on the conditions under which the separation could be conducted. I'll skip over some of this. I designed an apparatus in which one could make the appropriate measurements and develop the theory for the process and showed how the degree of separation of hydrogen from methane could be controlled by the amount of steam that was allowed to flow into the mixture while the hydrogen counter-diffused against the steam. And it proved to be quite successful in correlating the process. But we found that the consumption of steam per unit of hydrogen extracted was so high as to make the process unattractive under the economic conditions then prevailing. I worked out enough of the theory of the process to show that this was a necessary consequence of the diffusion rates, and I proposed the name mass diffusion for the process by analogy with thermal diffusion, which was by then already known as a way of separating gas mixtures. The combination of my assignment to this project, the prompt and definitive, though unfavorable, result we secured, and my choice of the name mass diffusion was a fine example of serendipity, happy chance. 6 months later, when Keith was asked by Eager Murphy, then chairman of the U.S. OSRD, to undertake exploratory research on the gaseous diffusion process to produce uranium-235, Keith concluded erroneously that my work on mass diffusion made me well qualified to develop gaseous diffusion. In fact, except for the word diffusion in common, there wasn't the slightest similarity between the two processes. I've had more damn good luck in my life. First meeting my wife at MIT and then working for Kellogg, Keith, and getting assigned to the gaseous diffusion process. Where do we go from there?
Well, that brings us to when you start. Well, I think Kellex was formed in 42. The war started in 41, and Kellex, which was a subsidiary set up specifically for that project, for the Manhattan project.
Started in early 42, that's correct.
And you were held the title of head of process development.
That is correct. There was also a process design group that was headed by a fellow named Charlie King, a very capable chemical engineer from MIT.
And I was going to ask you about Ralph Landau, because I've interviewed him recently.
Yeah.
And he was in some respects involved with at Kellex.
Yeah, but in a very minor way. He was brought in to assist in the production of what we subsequently called special chemicals. These were substances which would not react with fluorine, but which could be used as coolants or lubricants in the gaseous diffusion process in case there was a leak of the very strongly fluorinating process gas, uranium hexafluoride, into the mixture. So his problem was to develop efficient processes for producing these hitherto unmade, hitherto non-existent compounds, such as perfluoroheptane and perfluoroxylene. We, in the process, this was before Ralph came into the company, we in the process development section of the company recognized that it would be a serious loss of process gas and possibly an explosion hazard if ordinary hydrocarbon coolants were to leak into the process gas, uranium hexafluoride, which was almost as strongly fluorinating as fluorine gas itself. So, having been told that cost was no object, we recommended that the company obtain, through the Manhattan Project, compounds which had never even been made before, but which we assumed would exist, namely perfluoroheptane and perfluoroxylene, respectively C7F16 and C8F16. We predicted that these compounds would have boiling points sufficiently different from uranium hexafluoride so that if they leaked into the process gas, first of all, there would be no reaction, which was an important criterion, but second, that they could be separated from it by partial condensation with the recycle of both the coolant and the process gas. Whereas if they had exactly the same boiling point as uranium hexafluoride, there might be no opportunity to get them out. They would go along and would concentrate either with the product, which we definitely didn't want, or with the tails, which would plug up that part of the plant. So we looked up what was known about the physical properties of some of the lower fluorocarbons. C2F6 was probably known by then, and C3F8 may have been known. We found out what the relationship of their boiling point was to those of the corresponding hydrocarbons, and we predicted that if C7F16 was made, it would have a molecular weight sufficiently above those that of uranium hexafluoride. Let me see what that would be. Fluorine is 18 and carbon is 12. So CF2 is 12, 48. Forgotten. But anyway, C7F16 would be the first of the normal fluorocarbons to have a boiling point higher, have a molecular weight higher than that of uranium hexafluoride, and would therefore concentrate in the tails with the U238 hexafluoride. Whereas if we use one of the lighter fluorocarbons, it would concentrate with the heads, the product, and would so dilute the gas that's being processed in that part of the plant that it would, to all intents and purposes, plug the separating units. So without these compounds ever having been made before, we specified that for the successful operation of the plant, we had to have 2 million pounds, that was the inventory of coolant in the plant, of C7F16. General Groves turned the problem over to the DuPont Company. I remember going down to Wilmington at his request and making this was more than a suggestion. It wasn't exactly a demand, but it was an indication that we badly needed, I forget whether it was 2 million or 7 million pounds, an enormous amount of a compound that had never been made before. And Dr. Howard W. Ellie, who was the director of research for DuPont that day, didn't bat an eye. He said, well, we'll see what we can do about it. And by the time the plant went into operation, by God, they had the required amount of this compound that had never been made before. And they made it at first by the reaction of fluorine with heptane, which was a very dangerous reaction. Subsequently, they found ways of doing it with some other less aggressive fluorinating agents. And later, still, they found that another, in fact, it was a DuPont suggestion, another compound, C8F16, which could be made from xylene, would do just as well and would be easier to make.
Now, you were head of the process development group. You were responsible for what in terms of the, I'd say, the K25?
Well, one of my divisions was responsible for the process design of the plant. That was in charge of Charles C. King, a very able chemical engineer from MIT. And I was also in charge of developing the appropriate theory for the gaseous diffusion cascade, which was handled by a very capable theoretical chemist named Elliot Montrell, who went on to a distinguished career as a theoretical chemical spectroscopist. And Montrell and his associates, one of whose name I remember, Joe Lehner, developed the highly advanced and very appropriate mathematical theory of how a cascade of some 4,000 stages would respond to time-dependent disturbances in its performance, whether the cascade would magnify the disturbance, leading ultimately to a disruptive or destructive surge in pressure, or whether the cascade would damp out these fluctuations as it went through successive stages. The British at that time had proposed the construction of a plant which had operated such low pressures that it worked in the laminar regime where viscous flow took place, mm-hmm. and where their theorists could prove that the cascade would be stable because of the fact that the flow in viscous flow is proportional to the square of the pressure difference, whereas in turbulent flow, which we had in our plant, flow is proportional to the first power of the pressure difference, and they were certain that our cascade would be unstable because of the fact that disturbances would propagate up the plant instead of going down the plant. So we had to develop a means for stabilizing the flow in the plant, which involved the use of pressure control valves similar to the ones which are used in natural gas plants, and you're probably familiar with them, where a sensor determines the pressure in the plant, and there's a valve with whose control element is set to open if the pressure is too high to relieve the pressure, or to close if the pressure is too low to allow the pressure to build up. So we specified that this kind of control be assigned to the plant. Our British colleagues, who were enamored of working at very low pressures at which laminar flow took place in which the cascade would itself be stable, were convinced that this wouldn't work, but people at Kellogg were convinced from their use of pressure control valves and other less complicated equipment that it would work, but they needed proof. So I was instructed to develop the theory for this and find out that prove that our system would work. Well, I wasn't a theorist, and this called for advanced solution of multivariable partial differential equations with time dependence and space dependence and a lot of other things. It was no task for me at all